Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's Compliance Week News Podcast. I'm Joe Mott, staff writer at Compliance Week. Can lawyers ethically collect whistleblower bounties? The New York County Lawyers Association issued an opinion that tackled the question of whether a New York lawyer can ethically participate in the Securities and Exchange Commission's bounty program by revealing confidential information about a client. Its conclusion? Doing so would betray client confidences and be fraught with ethical issues. It remains to be seen whether the State Bar Association or others might make a similar stand, but that decision comes on the heels of a $14 million bounty the SEC, under a program established by the Dodd-Frank Act, gave to an anonymous tipster. It was a big money award that's likely to precede many others. We spoke to Gregory Keating, co-chair of the law firm Littler's Whistleblower and Retaliation Practice Group, about these recent developments.
Very active developments continue to percolate in this area. I think what you're seeing is actually kind of a stark contrast of two developments I've been watching over the last 6 months coming to fruition. So the first one is, you mentioned the $14 million bounty award. Joe, I've long said that there are a number of engines that are really driving this whistleblower frenzy right now, and one of those engines is a rise in awareness of the kind of pot of gold that may be out there for whistleblowers. Awareness in the public, awareness by the plaintiff's bar, and this is all contributing to a bit of a feeding frenzy, because obviously when people know that there's not just hundreds or thousands of dollars at stake, but in fact millions of dollars at stake in terms of reward and attorney's fees, that definitely piques interest. And that's exactly, you know, what happened this week with the SEC award. Many people had complained a bit, Joe, over the last 6 to 9 months about the dearth of SEC awards under the Dodd-Frank bounty program. We had, as of Monday, to date only had two awards, both of them quite small in size. And I think a number of people were expressing frustration as to why there weren't more awards. And I have said publicly on many occasions, it is in the pipeline, it is coming, there will be significant awards. And sure enough, Monday was proof positive of that. I think it's only going to fuel, again, this awareness and trend. I'd note, for example, that, you know, there's a prominent plaintiff's firm out of California, I believe, that just in conjunction with this issuance of an award, just last week announced with much fanfare that they have a new app for their Droid and iPhones for whistleblowing, where you can simply put which state you're in and which industry you work in and a number of other questions, and automatically you'll get all kinds of information about your rights as a whistleblower. I think this type of stuff is going to continue, this direct reach out to individuals, and the award is also, in my opinion, one that is going to continue. I predict we're going to see a steady stream of these awards. The SEC has a trust fund of over $450 million that they have access to give out these bounty awards. And I guess, you know, under the heading of irony, on the first day of the government shutdown, we give $14 million to a whistleblower. I found that to be somewhat interesting. In any event, as to your second topic of last week, I said that this is another development I've been watching, and it's a bit in contrast. I alluded to the engines that have been fueling the whistleblower frenzy a little bit ago, and one of those is the public awareness. But another one that we've seen a noticeable, a distinct and noticeable pulling in of the reins has been in the area of what I call judicial expansion of rights and remedies. So in other words, you've got, up until this summer, you had a very strong current of opinions or developments in the courts, by the courts, and by the Administrative Review Board of the Department of Labor, which had simply continued to expand and make broader the rights and remedies of whistleblowers. Examples of that would be six U.S. Supreme Court cases between 2006 and 2013, the Administrative Review Board and its watershed developments that have been going on there in the last 18 to 24 months. All of this has made it easier for a whistleblower to bring a case. Well, that has been changing. First, you had the United States Supreme Court case in June called Nassar, in which they adopted a very strict, narrow interpretation of the causation element, which really took a lot of people by surprise, sharply divided opinion, and the court in the opinion expressly notes in its reasoning that, you know, one of the reasons the court decided to go in this direction is that these claims are really percolating wildly, and there are at least some occasions, and this is the court's words, not mine, when, you know, individuals may seek to protect themselves from another otherwise lawful action by claiming some kind of protected activity, and then they're wrapped in a bubble and can't be retaliated against. So that was the first development. The second development in this trend I'm seeing of the judicial expansion of rights and remedies being pared back was the Asadi decision by the Fifth Circuit that came shortly after Nassar in August, I believe. And in that case, the court adopted a very narrow interpretation of who is a whistleblower under Dodd-Frank and said that to be a whistleblower, you have to have gone to the SEC. In other words, you know, it doesn't matter how loudly you complained and what type of protected activity you engaged in the workforce. If you didn't go to the SEC, you get no bounty. And then finally, this latest development is one that obviously, if implemented by the New York Bar Association, this recommendation would dramatically winnow the pool of people who could seek a bounty, because it would eliminate sort of any of the in-house professionals who might try to come forward.
Keating's own research looked not just at in-house counsel who make the leap to whistleblower, but compliance officers who do so as well. Is this a growing trend for those with the privileged positions, as they spill the beans?
Unquestionably, Joe, we are seeing a lot more of these folks come forward. I chair the whistleblower practice, co-chair the whistleblower practice here at Littler, and as a result of a host of cases that I had come onto my radar screen between 2011 and 2012, literally a dozen or more cases involving in-house counsel or compliance officers. In conjunction with a number of communications that I had with colleagues of mine around the country, I decided there is a trend here, and we're seeing more and more of this. In addition, Joe, this area is fraught with legal issues. My own personal view is that the attorney-client privilege is a very sacrosanct and hallowed obligation, and I find it anathema that individuals can work in a company and be exposed to privileged information and then go and use that as a sword against the company after they leave for either a bounty or a some kind of claim of retaliatory discharge. And my own personal view is a lot more aligned with some of the stricter states like California, which really put the attorney-client privilege up a lot higher on the scale than perhaps the incentive of a bounty or retaliation for alleged whistleblowing.
Compliance officers, unlike legal counsel, are overseen by no state bar association. How should this change how companies view and address their whistleblowing activity?
Well, it's a very difficult one because and I, as I alluded to earlier, I have seen had a number of cases in exactly this area, and it is a difficult one because you're, you know, the folks that you are entrusting to try and ferret out and deal with compliance issues, then sort of turn around and want to go report on you. You're not, as a matter of law, able to effectuate any type of contractual waiver of the right to be a whistleblower. That is unequivocally not allowed by Dodd-Frank. So you can't contract away these rights. I think that the best advice that I could give in this area for folks in compliance would be twofold. Number one, I think it's really important, super important, that companies today looking to hire an in-house compliance professional do their homework and really look carefully to make sure that you're getting someone who not only is committed to fostering a compliant organization and has expertise in that regard, but also has a really solid, strong track record with regard to prior employment. Because if there's one pattern that often is discernible, quite frankly, it's that individuals may have a propensity to engage in a familiar track record where they jump from employer to employer, and there may even be prior lawsuits involved. So, number one, really do a good job with your lawful background checks and looking into references and so forth and so on. And number two, beef up your own company policies with regard to making really clear what your expectations are with regard to confidential information, use and disclosure of such information, because just because a compliance professional may be able to, either go to an agency or may be able to use certain information in defense of pursuit of a claim, if that individual brazenly ignores, clear express obligations during employment, and for example, downloads and sends to his own Gmail account, all kinds of confidential information, that very well could be separate and independent grounds to say, well, we have a right to terminate you, and has nothing to do with any protected activity.
That was Gregory Keating, a member of the law firm Littler's Board of Directors and co-chair of its Whistleblower and Retaliation Practice Group. He provided some insight into the SEC's Whistleblower Bounty Program and what happens when in-house counsel and compliance officers become the tipsters. That's all for this week's podcast. I'm Compliance Week's Joe Mott. Thank you all for listening.